So this morning, I'd like to continue with more verses from Vasubandhu's 30 verses. Yesterday, we talked about the first verse. So today, I want to talk about the next couple of verses. But before I do that, I want to just give you like a little background. I'm now going to summarize the history of Buddhist thought. in a few sentences, just to give you a little, so you know the context for this text of Vasubandhu. So here's what happened in the history of Buddhist thought and practice. The first thing that happened was the Buddha's great insight, like all great insights, totally obvious, but you didn't think of it. Everything is impermanent. There is nothing is abiding. There's nothing there other than the flash and the flow of impermanence. No self, no nothing. Which, as I say, is like crushingly obvious and even scientific. Everything is constantly shifting and altering. Of course that's true. How could there be anything that is not like that? How can there be any substance that's not shifting and changing just like everything else? So in other words, there's just shifting and changing, nothing in the middle of it. You can't find anything other than the shifting and the changing. So that means that the common experience we all have of me, myself, must be some kind of persistent illusion which we insist on, and therefore we're constantly frustrated when we can never hold on to ourselves or anything that we would like to hold on to. So we're suffering. So when we finally get it, that there is no fixed or real self, that there's only the flow of coming and going events, then we can safely let go of our self-protection and just leap into the everything that is ourselves, shifting and changing. And then this is what Buddha called awakening. Totally simple, you know, easy to understand, harder to do, of course, but we can easily get this point. So now, in the centuries after this initial insight of the Buddha, a practice developed to analyze and categorize this ever-shifting flow of events. And doing that seemed really important because the Buddha already taught that these shifting events create the climate of our minds, the climate of our human experience. They are making karmic impressions moment after moment in our hearts. So if we want to stop being the miserable victims of our own past and of all that's happened to us, we should understand the nature of these events as they come and go. So let's analyze them and understand them. And when you start to analyze them, you recognize that some of them are actually quite wholesome and positive. And they create a climate of happiness and ease. And we can build on those positive events toward awakening. Some events, on the other hand, are not positive, are quite unwholesome, and lead to tremendous suffering. We can begin to learn to identify those and de-emphasize those, let go of them, and then we can reduce our suffering. So Buddhists took a great interest in discriminating between these various events and learning how to encourage some and discourage others. But of course, you got to first be able to tell the difference in detail. So they were really focused on this analysis. It's a very sophisticated psychological system and practice. But the problem with it is that if you begin to invest too much energy in analyzing these events in order to shape your own happiness, inevitably you will begin to believe in this analysis. And then you could find yourself stuck in it and tied up in knots around it. You could get overly interested in your own mind, and this would become its own kind of difficulty. And I think this happens to us these days. I think we can really well understand this. A lot of people who take up practice get like overly interested in their own minds, in their own mental process. We can become convinced that we're seeing our own minds, we're seeing our own process. We can think we know what's going on. We can think we understand ourselves. And this becomes quickly a problem. Because we get like solipsistically wrapped up, you know, in our own minds. And then we can actually increase our stress. You know, I was stressed out, and now I'm stressed out because I'm stressed out. And I see how stressed out I am. And now I'm more stressed out, and I'm more upset. And furthermore, I feel guilty that I should be doing better because I'm a Buddhist. And it's un-Buddhistic to be being the way I am, and so on and so on. We could actually, you know, begin to exponentially make matters worse. So there's a problem with actually understanding our own minds and being focused on that understanding. So then, in the middle of this problem, I'm still giving you the history of Buddhist thought and practice. In the middle of this problem, along come the Prajnaparamita gang. So they come along, and they said, so you guys analyzing your mind and everything, and getting all hung up on this, don't you remember that the Buddha said there is no abiding self? And they said, yes, of course we remember that. That's why we're analyzing everything, because we're analyzing states of mind. No self, just states of mind. And the Prajnaparamita guy said, well, actually, what the Buddha was saying is not that there's just that there's no self. There's nothing at all that has an abiding self. Not even states of mind have an abiding self. You are paying attention to something that actually doesn't exist. All dharmas are empty. Don't get so excited. Don't be so upset about everything. All dharmas are empty. Your brilliant analysis has no fundamental basis. And all you have to do is recognize that, be that through and through, and then you'll be able to live in peace, and you won't have to analyze every single thought and feeling that you have. And this is pretty much the classical Zen approach, as found in the famous poem of the sixth ancestor in the Platform Sutra, where he says, somebody says, practice is wiping clean the mirror of all of its defilements. And the sixth ancestor says, well, but there is no mirror, so what are you going to wipe? That's the beginning of Zen, classical Zen practice. But now, there is a limitation to that also. Because while we are dutifully trying to realize that all dharmas are empty, we can't help but notice that we're still having a lot of problems. So, is the idea here that we're all supposed to remain a total wreck until we get enlightened? Until we break through and see for ourselves that all dharmas are empty, and in the meantime, we're supposed to like just go on and on with our stupid behavior and stupid way of living? No, that really doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? We really do have to address that. So, maybe we could say the classical Zen approach is a little too extreme. It sounds like a good idea, but in actual fact, it's a little too extreme. Maybe it doesn't really help us with our human problems pre-enlightenment. So, sudden enlightenment, the teaching that is proposed in the Sixth Ancestor Sutra, the beginning of Zen, the Platform Sutra, sudden enlightenment, the seeing of the emptiness of all dharmas, this is a fundamental thing that we should certainly always be paying attention to, but it's also somewhat limited if you make that into an event or an ideology, or you privilege that too much, it becomes counterproductive. It's a little distorted. After all, we're living here as we are. We're not elsewhere or someone else. You know, this is our life. And this now is where Vasubandhu enters the picture. That's why I'm giving you that background. Because this is the situation that Vasubandhu, even though he wrote some centuries before the Sixth Ancestor Sutra, all these thoughts were already part of Buddhism in Vasubandhu's time. So he wants to give us a way of practice that fully integrates both sides of this equation. So he starts with the concept of consciousness. And in the 30 verses, it's very clear, if unstated in the beginning, that there is actually no such thing as consciousness. Vasubandhu is not telling us there's this thing or this state or this substance or something called consciousness. It's clear that consciousness is not a thing, it's not a substance, it's not a self, it's not a God. Consciousness actually is a word that we are using to describe, and we're using this word for a good reason, as a different way of describing the endless, beginningless flow of empty dharmas that we were talking about yesterday and that Vasubandhu refers to in the first verse. That's why actually Vasubandhu does not say in the text consciousness. He always says the transformations of consciousness. Because consciousness cannot ever be a thing that stays still. It cannot be a state or an entity of any sort. But it's useful for the purposes that Vasubandhu has here to start with the idea of consciousness as the first verse does. Because then we can analyze and understand that consciousness in such a way as to reduce our pain and suffering and find a way of happiness. So in the first half of the 30 verses, I think the first 16 verses, as Ben Connolly explains in his book, Vasubandhu is writing about consciousness and how to work with afflictive emotions, which is an absolutely essential practice. And the second half of the text is about seeing the emptiness of all dharmas, which in terms of consciousness is what he calls the revolution or the turning around or the uprooting or the overturning of consciousness. And he mentions this already in the fourth verse that I hope to get to this morning. When consciousness is turned around through our practice, the metaphors of self and other are now fully appreciated and understood as they are. And then we can find a way to live our lives without self-protection, with full trust in the full range of reality inside and out, and with the love that is inherent in the process of transformation of consciousness itself. So that's the background. And now we're on the second verse. following on what we said yesterday. So he's stated in the first verse that everything conceived of as self and other is actually the transformation of consciousness. And now in this second verse, he's saying, so what are the characteristics of this transformation of consciousness? And he says there are three characteristics to it. One is the maturation of karma. Second is self-consciousness. And third is projection. That's what he says in the second verse. So the maturation of karma is a really profound thought. It means that this moment arises like this particular moment in which I'm speaking to you, in which we seem to be people in Canada in a meditation retreat, various people. This moment gets here from the ancient past. It's the maturation of the fruit of karma from the past. And of course, who thinks of this? But when you think about it, it's very obvious. We would not be sitting here as we are unless in the past someone conceived of the idea of an Asian center at UBC, raised the funds, hired an architect to build it, who brought in builders, who built it. But not only that, none of that would have happened without the entire history of Asian culture and Western culture, right? Asian culture had to pre-exist in Western culture in all of its manifestations in order for us to be sitting here. And then each one of us had to have a past and a history that somehow caused us to have the idea that we should be here, right? Otherwise, we would be existing, but somewhere else. All of that, a huge amount of stuff had to happen, right? And let's not stop there. What if there were no planet Earth? We wouldn't be here, sitting here. Human beings wouldn't exist, right? Well, but what if there had been no, like, Big Bang and cosmos? There would be no planet Earth. In other words, it's literally the case that everything that has existed in the past has had to exist in order to make it possible for this particular moment in which you are hearing my sentence could exist. So every single moment that arises anywhere in your life or anywhere else is a moment that arises as the maturation of karma, called vipaka, the maturation of karma. That is the first characteristic of the transformation of consciousness. The energy of the whole past makes the possibility of a present moment manifesting as the transformation of consciousness. And this is the first and most fundamental dimension of the transformation of consciousness, that if we appreciated it all the time, it would really make a different life, right? If we really remembered this, felt it. It's there to be felt, if we could feel it. Now, in the original system of analysis, the Abhidharma system that I was talking about a minute ago, they proposed a set of six different consciousnesses, which consisted of the five sense consciousnesses, and which they conceived of each one as a different form of consciousness, which is really true, you know. It's like, I often think of this. Hearing something is a totally different thing from seeing something. It's like you even wonder, like, how could hearing and seeing, which are so different from each other, exist in the same universe? It seemed like you'd need a whole universe for hearing and a different universe for seeing. They're so different, you know, from each other. And the five consciousnesses are each conceived of as a different consciousness. And then the sixth one is mental consciousness, and the object of mental consciousness is not a sight object or a sound object, it's a thought or a sensation or a feeling. And since it was a cardinal teaching of the Buddha that there is no abiding self, there is no self-consciousness. There's only the six consciousnesses. And the early Buddha said that what we experience as self-consciousness is simply an illusion projected onto the other six consciousnesses. And that was actually the whole point of the Abhidharma analysis, to be able to discern the flow of consciousness as it is without the projection of self. Then you could be free of self-clinging and free of self-protection. And the Abhidharmas, though, seem to think, although, of course, there were lots of different Abhidharmas with lots of different point of views. There are many, many. There's lots of fascinating debates and so on and so on. But in general, we could say that the Abhidharmas seem to think that the self is unreal, but that consciousness and its contents are real. So now, Vasubandhu, in his text, is making two, like, innovations, very daring innovations in the whole history of Buddhist thought up to this time. First, he's saying, there is self-consciousness. He adds the idea of self-consciousness to his analysis. And I'm sure he did this because he probably noticed, as maybe you have also noticed, that no matter how many times it says in the book, you don't have a self. And no matter how much you believe it, it just keeps seeming like you do. You know? I just can't get over the fact that I seem to think I'm here. You know, I just can't help it. And in all honesty, we would have to admit that, you know, it's very likely that even the most enlightened Zen master still thinks she's there eating lunch and having thoughts, probably. So with great relief, you know, Vasubandhu gives us a chance to admit that we seem to have self-consciousness. And really, I think that his teaching is the first time in Buddhism that self-consciousness is actually given a name and considered to be have some, at least we'll see, but some status as an existent thing. And this is actually a very skillful improvement, I think, on the earlier form of analysis. This sense of self, the sense of the observer, the sense that there is a field of awareness in which these events are coming and going. And so, what's really brilliant and important about what Vasubandhu is telling us here is he's saying that, therefore, our goal here is not to think that we don't have a self or get over having a self. Our goal is to fully understand the nature of this self-consciousness, and by understanding its nature, to transform it, turn it around at the root. And then Vasubandhu actually doesn't use these terms in the text, but in later commentaries of his text, they say that self-consciousness is transformed into what's called the wisdom of equality. And that means that the virtue of self-consciousness is that you see each and every thing as self, and each and everything as equally identified as you, and equally appreciated. So in other words, you being you enables you to see the world with an equal sense of love and appreciation. And you turn around self-consciousness till it becomes the mirror, the great, not the mirror wisdom, the wisdom of equality. So, what is the transformation of consciousness? First, it's the maturation of karma, and second, it's manas, or self-consciousness. The third element in the flow of the transformation of consciousness is called projection. That's my word, not mine, but other translators use that word. Ben, in his text, actually translates the word projection, the word that's often translated as projection, he translates it as the imagery of sense objects. It's the third element, the imagery of sense objects. In other words, our projection of this world in which we seem to find ourselves. The experienced world is the six consciousnesses proposed by the Abhidharmists, sight, consciousness, oral consciousness, and so forth, up to mental consciousness, which is thought and conception. But whereas the Abhidharmists took all this to be real, Vasubandhu is in this text saying very clearly that all this is projection. It's a bunch of passing imagery. It's a painting. This world is a painting. Like Dogen says, a painting of a rice cake. It's the painting of a poem. And the word here is vijñapti, which actually means more or less projection. And we have that word, of course, in psychology, which means pretty much the same thing. We say, you know, a person will project their past onto the present, and therefore they will create a distorted present, right? Because they're not seeing the present, they're distorting the present by projecting their own past onto the present, like a movie or something, you know? And pretty much that is what Vasubandhu means here by projection, except that Vasubandhu is saying that everything is projection. The whole world is actually projection. It's not like we're distorting something, that it's like the whole world as we see it is projection, which is an astonishing and even disturbing thought, right? We didn't think the world was projection. We thought it was actually, if it's like this world that's making me crazy, and actually this world is just a projection, then why do I need to be crazy? Why am I letting a projection push me around? The world is a dream. Vasubandhu is saying the world that we think we're living in is actually a dream. That's why we call enlightenment awakening, right? Although it's very important to note that we're not talking about awakening from the dream, because there's only the dream. We're talking about awakening in the dream. Awakening in the dream. So anyway, that's what Vasubandhu says in the few words of the second verse. So now he goes on to flesh out further his map of consciousness. He has a map that includes eight consciousnesses. So we've already heard about the seven, the six consciousnesses and self-conscious. Now he's going to talk about the eighth consciousness. And this is another innovation of Vasubandhu's. The eighth consciousness, called Alaya Vijnana, storehouse consciousness. What is storehouse consciousness? It's the same thing as vipaka, the maturation of karma in every moment. Defined from another angle, seen from another angle, the maturation of karma in every moment is called the eighth consciousness, the storehouse consciousness, a kind of universal consciousness. Now remember, do these eight consciousnesses really exist as Vasubandhu describes them? He doesn't say they do or they don't. That's not the point. The point is, let's have a system, a way of looking at our lives that helps. Just like the Buddha, who did not want to be a philosopher or a metaphysician or a scientist, he wanted to be a doctor to promote healing. So also for Vasubandhu, the operative part of the maturation of karma, the arising of this moment, important part is that we are bearing witness to it. It is our lives. So he calls this global consciousness of the arising of the world in a present moment, saturated by the endless past, he calls it Alaya Vijnana, storehouse consciousness. This eighth consciousness is a very famous feature of Vasubandhu's teaching. And once we appreciate it, it gives our lives, which can seem so small and circumscribed, a tremendous sense of dimension, meaning, and mystery. So now the third verse defines Alaya Vijnana. And it says, Alaya Vijnana holds all the seeds, and that what it holds and the perception of location are unknown. That's what the third verse says. So what does it mean? Well, first it means, like I already was saying, that this moment is part of the endless process of transformation of consciousness that comes from the endless past. That all that has ever happened, everywhere and nowhere and anywhere, forever, comes to fruit in this moment of your life, right in the middle of your life. Every moment of your consciousness is bringing with it the entire endlessly deep and rich process of flow. Your life, just the way it is, without any improvement or anything different about it, just the way it is so much more than you think it is. This is what he's saying. It's a great idea. I like it. And you like it too. But it's much more than an idea, right? It's much more than an idea. Because honestly, as you continue to practice, and practice for us, you know, in Zen, that doesn't mean like coming to the retreat, it's part of it. But for us, practice means our life lived in the spirit, in the light of practice. So as you continue to live your life as practice, you will feel this. You will feel it. You'll see it everywhere. You will understand somehow, although you can't explain it or know it exactly, but you will feel that there is so much more going on than you know. You feel and trust the vastness and the depth of your life. You will trust the endlessness out of which this very moment arises. And you will trust every moment as containing and expressing everything you ever need, right here, in every moment. All the good and all the bad, all the seeds, as he says in the verse, they're all right here. And that's why we have to pay attention. That's why we have to take care of our lives, because if we're careless, if we're heedless, if we go around cultivating and watering the seeds of suffering, we will make a lot more suffering for ourselves, and the entire past and going forward will be saturated with our confusion. And the opposite happens. We can make a world of goodness and a life of goodness. If you are dismayed and confused and horrified by this world that we're all living in, as you should be if you actually pay attention to what goes on in this world every day. You don't need to be confused about it. It is perfectly understandable that the world is the way it is. Think of all the stupid things we have done to one another. All the violence, all the horrible things. For how long have we been doing these things? Since the beginning of human beings, to one another. So if you look at the world and you think, what a mess, you understand, oh yeah, of course it's a mess. No wonder that when a moment arises, there's a lot of pain. No wonder. So, right now, in every moment, we have a big job to do. We have to cultivate and water the seeds of goodness. And in this text, we won't get to it today, but in this text, Vasubandhu will explain to us in detail how do we do that. Because all the seeds are here in all the moments, and it's up to us what sort of contribution we will make to the creation of subsequent moments of reality. What seeds will we water, and what seeds will we not water? This teaching is telling us that in every single moment, we are fully empowered, and not only empowered, but responsible to change our lives and the whole world. Every single moment for the good. And what is the nature of this alaya vijnana that works that way? It's unknown, he says. We don't know. It doesn't have any boundaries. It doesn't have any location, and by definition, we cannot know it. Not knowing is most intimate. So in these first three verses, Vasubandhu then is setting forth the basic structure, the basic understanding of reality that the rest of the text will discuss in more detail. So now I'm going to go on to the next verse. Because this whole thing is pretty global. Now we got to get down to like the local. That's, you know, your body and mine, my body and mine, and how the world appears as it squeezes through this little filter of me. Once we begin to get the hang of how the transformation of consciousness manifests right here where we are, we can begin to see how we can deal with all the stuff that arises all the time in our minds and hearts. And we can have a path for straightening ourselves out. And so he says in the fourth verse, this is the fourth verse, I'm going to directly quote it. The alaya arrives with five basic factors, always five basic factors. Sense contact, attention, sensation, perception, and volition. It always comes with those factors. And it is unobstructed. It's equanimous. It's karmically neutral. It is like a river flowing. In awakening, it's turned around, like I was saying earlier, it's turned around at its root, transformed at its base. So this now describes what we can observe as basic mind that always appears in our lives whenever we're conscious. There's always sense consciousness and so on, as he says. Because our organism, the human organism, which is our mind, our heart, sense organs and so on, it's a conduit for the world to appear. In other words, we are like musical instruments to sound the song of the world. We and all other things that exist sound the world's song. So this is how the instrument works. It inherently arises, as he says, peacefully, without any hindrance. Doesn't have good karma or bad karma. It's beyond that. It's a flowing river, rushing along, clear and pure. And to us, it looks like a moment of personal consciousness. And that moment always comes with some sense contact, because consciousness can never arise by itself. It isn't a thing that has a self-existence, so it can never arise by itself. Something always evokes consciousness, because there's no independent consciousness, just as there are no independent persons. There could not be a person. A person alone is like a chicken with lips. You can say it, you know, but it could never exist. First of all, you could start with your parents, right? They don't exist, you don't exist, right? But everything about you requires the existence of others. There could not be a person without other persons. So every moment of consciousness will only arise, can arise independently. It only arises dependent on a contact with something. Eyes co-evolve with things to see, right? Ears with things to hear. A thought with the mind. And I always say, if you think about all the Zen stories, every single one of them, you notice this teaching. Awakening always arises on a moment of deeply appreciated contact with another person, with something seen or heard, sometimes with language. Awakening, then, is nothing more than consciousness truly appreciated and experienced. And it only comes when there is a moment of meeting, a moment of contact. So every moment of consciousness must include contact. And that's why Dogen says, every moment of life, every moment of practice is awakening. We're not looking for a future special moment of awakening. We're looking to find the awakening that's already present here on each moment, at every point of meeting. So there's always contact and there's always some awareness. Because without awareness, there is no actual consciousness. Maybe you have had this experience, probably with your spouse. Somebody's saying something to you and you literally don't hear it. You actually don't hear it. And you don't hear it because you were thinking of something else at the time. So you actually literally did not hear the words that somebody said. Maybe you've seen this, like if you're sitting facing the wall and your eyes are open, but you don't see anything because your awareness is not on your sight consciousness. So there has to be awareness in order for there to be consciousness. So in other words, some attention has to be present. Then there has to be some sensation. The object of consciousness registers in you, and then you have some kind of reaction. Somehow, that which you encounter vibrates the strings of your organism, and it stirs you in some way. And then you engage with it, you perceive it, you come out to say hi to it. And then once you do that, there's some volition. Somehow you respond, and when you respond, the flow goes on. So this is Vasubandhu's profound analysis of consciousness. And this is what happens when there's karmic maturation in a moment of consciousness in the middle of endlessness. And this is how it appears locally in your experience and mine. Because this is the kind of being that we are. We always have contact, attention, sensation, perception, volition. And the last thing that Vasubandhu says in the same verse, as I quoted, says, in awakening, it, meaning alaya vijnana, this moment of arising, is overturned at its root. And it's Zen practice, like, focuses on this one sentence. This is like the sort of classical energy of Zen practice. This is fully appreciating the emptiness of all dharmas, seeing the unknowable nature of alaya, the endless interconnection and insubstantiality of all that we experience. And this is why we sit. You know, we're practicing this in our sitting. It's very simple. You know, it sounds so fabulous, I think, anyway. But it's really kind of not that big a deal. Because in sitting, all we're doing is sort of committing ourselves to sitting down and not chasing objects. This is the commitment we make. We're going to sit here, and we're not going to be chasing objects the way we always are all the time. We're going to take, as Dogen says, the backward step, and we're going to turn the light of awareness inwardly to illuminate the self. How do we do that? I mean, it's fancy language. What does it all mean? It's very simple. We come back to the breathing. We stop pursuing our thoughts and ideas and sensations. They're there, but we just turn the awareness back, right? To the breathing, to the body, to the different sensations in the body. In other words, we turn the awareness constantly back to presence, to vipaka as it arises moment after moment, not chasing after objects. And, you know, we don't make a big deal out of this. And it is very simple, and anybody can do it. And anybody can do it really well. But it's really very radical, this simple practice of Zazen. It's really very radical. As Vasubandhu says, when we sit in Zazen, we are letting go of outward objects. Because we know there are no outward objects, right? Actually, it's all projection. We're letting go of outward objects, and we're simply entering into the present moment. The present, ineffable, unknowable moment. Just as Dogen recommends. And oddly, you would think that doing such a practice would make you very weird. You know? Like as if you would be withdrawn from the world, right? In some kind of like non-dualistic Shangri-La. But it's the opposite. The point of this practice is to give us an honest, grounded, and realistic sense of who we are and what this world is. So that we will understand how to hold ourselves and the world in our hearts with love and also with tremendous stability. This is what I think is so great about our practice. It's very down to earth. It's very, very stable. It's not too spiritual, you know. It's the body. It's the breath. It's sitting, standing, walking, lying down. It's being in this world as it is, with the full tragedy and the full joy. We want to dwell in consciousness as it really is. We do not want to transcend anything. There is nothing to transcend, and there is no transcendence. We just want to be alive in this world as it is and feel it with poignancy, all of it. We want to know how it's possible to love in the light of this understanding, how it's possible to trust our lives, no matter what. This is what Vasubandha means when he says overturning at the root, turning our common paranoia. I think the average person, all of us, we're all literally paranoid, like we could all be institutionalized for paranoia. And that's natural. That's natural. Transforming that paranoia into trust. That's what it means to overturn at the root. So, I hope all of this detail about this sort of arcane, bizarre text was not too tedious to listen to. I'm trying to make it as clear as I can. But I just wanted to tell you about this. Sorry, couldn't help it. I've been studying this text now. I told you we were studying it in Upaya, and then I read the book even before that because I think I wrote the preface to the book. Pretty sure I did. And Ben asked me to do this, and so in order to write the preface to the book, I had to read it, so I read it already. So I really think it's a wonderful book, and like I say, I'm so admiring of Ben for doing this. So I'm really into it, and I've been talking about it, and I will continue to talk about it at my Dharma seminar at home. So if you think, but what about the other 26 verses? Well, you can go on the Everyday Zen website and follow along. I'll be talking about it probably for all of May and in June, and hope to get through all 30 verses. So that's my Dharma talk for today and for this last for the weekend. And so before saying goodbye, I just want to say a last word once again, which is thanks. Thanks for the lovely ceremony last night. It was very sweet. Thanks for your friendship over all these years. Thanks for your support over all these decades. And last night, Claire said what I wanted to say, and I think I forgot to say. And I think maybe having an appreciation of Vasubandha's point of view helps you to understand this. Dharma relations do not end. They never end. They can't end. When we touch each other and meet each other in the Dharma, even if it's only for a moment, but there's real meeting, it doesn't end. It goes on and on and on. So in a very real sense, we will always be practicing together, come what may. That's the truth. So thanks.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible.